Well, anyway, we're talking about the Celts, and they devised a theory about the Trinity. Yeah, it is on. Even before they had exposure to Christianity, and one of the members of their Trinity was called Yesu. And so when the missionaries came in the early centuries, and we're talking about Jesus, of course you need to realize that Jesus, the J sound for us today is a more modern invention. It's more of an English pronunciation, because originally the J was pronounced with a Y sound. So it was Jesus, all right, in the Greek, or when it was translated, it was Jesus. So here we have these missionaries talking about Jesus to the people that worship Yesu, okay? And so they immediately thought, yes, you're talking about this person that we know, that we worship, we don't know much about, but we worship him. And so this was how Christianity was able to make its way into the Celtic world, and they were already prepared to receive that message. And so the Celtic Church was established, and it became a very strong, powerful institution. It was very strong in Gaul, and it was very strong in Celtic Britain. And you need to realize that even though the Romans took over a big part of Britain, they didn't take over Wales either. And so you had this constant contact between these renegade Welsh people and the people in Roman Britain. But Christianity was spreading throughout the whole world at that time. And I have a very good book that, and I have extra copies of it. If you decide you'd like to buy it, it's a book written by Andrew Gray. He's an Anglican priest. Wrote it in the late 19th century, about 100 years ago. It's called The Origin and Early History of Christianity in Britain. And if you need the documentation, you know, and the quotes from the early church fathers, like Tertullian and Irenaeus and some of the others, to kind of back up some of the things that I said about Celtic Christianity, you'll find it in this book. And so I'll go ahead and kind of pass it around if you'd like to see it and kind of look at it. And I do have extra copies of that book. All right. This third little map here kind of shows Britain kind of up close there. And if you don't know your geography really well here, this kind of gives you a better idea where Wales is over there on the left-hand side, and then Roman Britain sort of up here at where you see this line with what almost looks like railroad tracks. That marks a wall that the Romans built in Britain to protect them from the Scots in the north. Of course, at that time, I think they were called the Picts, and to protect them from that. And so the Roman Britain pretty much constituted the lower island, and they did have control along the coastlines of Wales, but Wales is a very rugged country, kind of like the Appalachian Mountains in the eastern United States, and so they didn't control the hill country, and that's where the Celtic Welsh people lived there, and they didn't pay much attention to what the Romans were doing, and they lived up in the hill country, kind of like what some of the people in the hill country of the Appalachians do. They just don't have much use for revenue men, and they just kind of do as they please up there in those hills. So it's kind of the same way today.
And they didn't control Scotland either.
And they didn't control Scotland either. No. The Romans just kind of got tuckered out by the time they got up there. They decided, well, there's not much there to go after, so we'll just stop right here and build us a wall. And that's how it was. But see, the thing of it was is that Celtic Christianity sort of developed into kind of a different kind of Christianity than what you saw in the Roman Empire. What eventually happened in the Roman Empire was it sort of became like a state religion. But the Celts were a different kind of people. They were family-oriented. They were tribal in their orientation, and they lived in villages. And they weren't much interested in the big cities and what went on there. And so their outlook on Christianity was more personal. And one of their great leaders, who the Latins called a heretic, but I don't think was a heretic, and his name was Pelagius. And if you're familiar with Augustine and Pelagius, you'll find that there was a big controversy that one group had. Augustine taught the doctrine of predestination, and Pelagius taught the doctrine of free will. And we see that controversy later, you know, between Calvin and Arminius. You know, Calvin taught the predestination, and Arminius taught the free will. It's kind of passed down to us today. Well, I think a lot of that has to do with whether you're a city person or not, or a country person. Because when you're in the city, everything has to be controlled, doesn't it? Everything has to be regimented. You follow this street, the street's got to be in a straight line, and you got to do what the police officer says, and you know, the buildings have to be built a certain way, so there's got to be a lot of control in the city. And so, yeah, you want predestination there, don't you? But out in the country, you know, the country folk are, they do just wander through the woods or, you know, play in the creek or in the river if they want to. And if they want to build a fence or they want to build a hut or a house, you know, they just go do it and they don't have to get anybody's permission. So they're very much into free will, aren't they? They're kind of a free-spirited people. They're not interested in predestination and being controlled and that sort of thing. And their idea of God is he's more of a loving father rather than a king or a disciplinarian or a sovereign or a judge. You know, the country people just kind of look at it differently than the city people do. And so the Romans, of course, and Augustine was very concerned about the order of society. He felt that if we have to have a strict ordering of society, otherwise things fall apart. And Pelagius came down there from Wales, actually. He was a British monk. He came down from Wales and started preaching in Rome like David Wilkerson. You know, he just started preaching on the streets, and the people, a lot of them were converted to Christianity, and at first the leaders in Rome thought this was a great thing because the church is getting bigger all the time because of this preacher, and they were very reluctant to do anything about it when Augustine said, no, this has got to stop. And so they were very reluctant at first, But eventually, Augustine talked to the emperor and he said, you know, Pelagius is teaching what the Druids teach. And you remember, the Druids gave the Roman emperor such a hard time when they tried to conquer Gaul and when they tried to conquer Britain. And if he gets a chance to teach this Druidism, then the empire is going to fall apart. And so that persuaded the emperor and he decided, well, Pelagianism is a heresy. And all Pelagianism's got to stop being taught in the empire. So when that happened, then either people shut up or they left the empire. So they either went east to the Parthian kingdoms or they went west to Ireland and Wales and Scotland, where they were free to teach and preach what they believed and didn't have to worry about the emperor's soldiers coming to get them and throwing them in jail for teaching something that was against the church doctrine. And you got to remember, by the time of Augustine, we often forget this. In the beginning, Rome was pagan, wasn't it? But eventually, it got, at the time of Constantine, it officially became a Christian empire. And so, by the time of Augustine, the Roman Empire was supposed to be a Christian empire, see, and run according to Christian principles. And so, if you were contrary to what Christianity was teaching, then you were punished just as if you were out there, you know, killing someone or robbing someone. If you were teaching a false doctrine, then you were thrown in jail. See? So anyway, these were the conditions that were in the Roman Empire, and this is what became a part of the medieval period. There was this period of time when there was a great big flux at the fall of the Roman Empire, and you had the barbarian invasions. And Rome lost a lot of control, but eventually it regained the control through the Pope, and then the medieval period became very much like the Roman period had been in the way of the church having control over the people again, and over the institutions, and over the land. I mean, it was to such an extent that if you wanted to marry someone that wasn't approved, why, you could lose your children, would be considered bastards and would not be considered legitimate, and then your land would be forfeited to the church, see, or to someone that the church approved of, and it wouldn't be passed on to your children. So that's how much control they had over the world at that time in Europe. Medieval conditions were very poor. People lived short lives. The average lifespan for the average person was their early 40s. I'm 43 now. I would probably be about the end of my life now in medieval times, either through war or through pestilence or famine or disease of some kind. So people were short-lived at that time. The infant mortality rate, I think, was about 50%. So a child before the half the children that were born died in their infancy. During the medieval times, there were, of course, there were up and down periods, but it was a very bleak existence. And the only beautiful thing that people knew was the church. You know, all the people are out here living in these straw huts. And I should say that, you know, I have out here a straw house that I just built, you know. But they're all out here in these straw huts or these holes in the ground that people are living in. They live, yes, the animals are living with them in their house. Their animals live with them. Their cows and their pigs and their goats all live in the same house with them. And here these people are, they're living, and in the center of town is this beautiful structure, and it's the church. It might have stained glass windows, which would depict, you know, different biblical scenes on it. There are beautiful things in there. The priest wears beautiful robes and so on, and they had the choirs, and they had the beautiful music. Anything that was beautiful, anything that made life happy for the people, was in the church at that time. That was the only beautiful place there was. If you wanted to learn anything, you had to become a monk. You had to start, you had to dedicate yourself to the church. So the church had the keys of knowledge, and very often the keys of success had to come through the church. So that was the center of people's life. And then that brings me back to the Mass. You see, without the Mass and without confession, there was no salvation. And so for the people in their world, you remember now, they believe the world is flat here. There is nothing really out there beyond their world except this. They don't think about that there could be an adventurous land out there somewhere. And certainly, by the time of the Crusades and by the time of Marco Polo, wow, I mean, to think that there are kingdoms where there's gold, you know, tons of gold and vases made of gold, I mean, just, and silk and spices, and wow, it just, you know, that they could have an improved physical existence, that was just something that was really shocking to them. And so this was about the time that people were being challenged with the idea. They're saying, now, you know, Christianity doesn't really do much for people. The church doesn't really do much. It takes a lot. And they tell us that we're going to get our rewards when we get to heaven. And yet Jesus said many of these rewards we can get right now, as he says in Mark chapter 10. And we can get these things right now. And in addition to that, we can have eternal life. And they began to question the church. They thought it was rather convenient that the church would say, well, you know, just wait for heaven. Things will get better when you get to heaven. And they began to say, well, if the gospel is so wonderful, why can't it make a difference now? And so that was the challenge that began to occur in people's minds. And this is the challenge of the Grail. The story of the Holy Grail was teaching that there was once upon a time a wonderful time of plenty when there was enough food to eat and people lived without sickness. It was the time of Camelot, see, the time of King Arthur. There was a time of the Golden City, and that was lost, and we have to find this Holy Grail so that the blessings can be restored to the land. Now think about the fascination that this had on the minds of the people. To us today, you know, it's just an idle curiosity. But imagine a person that's living, say, in Bangladesh right now, or, you know, that, or in Africa, where there's starvation, and they think about America. They tell about America. You know, you mean they don't have to have They don't have to take pieces of cow manure to burn in order to stay warm.